Yeah.
Born ready, yo. Born ready. Come on, man. How long have we known each other? Crying out loud.
Ready since day the pandemic started, I guess. I don't know. Hi, it's Kimberly Adams in from Mollywood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the daily edition where Kai and I this week try to make sense of everything.
Everything. It is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. Your questions, our answers. We start today with a follow-up. Last week, Molly and I took a question about eviction moratoriums, or moratoria, I suppose, if you want to be Latin correct. I don't even know.
Latin about it?
I got an F. I got an F in college Latin, so anyway. Specifically, the question is, why you need a local moratorium when we already have a federal one? Some of you wrote in asking for more clarification. So we got actual expert advice from one of our listeners. His name is Michael Gibbons Camp. He is a senior attorney at Southeastern Ohio Legal Services in Chillicothe, Ohio. And we will say here he is writing in his personal capacity, not for the agency. Here's what he says about eviction moratoriums. In my view, this is a critical issue. The real reason a state needs a moratorium arises from federalism. Take the eviction moratorium under the CARES Act. It applies only to homes with a federally backed mortgage or leases which are federally subsidized. I've had the misfortune, he says, of having to explain to clients that no, the news they heard about evictions being banned during the shutdown was misleading. I worry that too many people believed that evictions and foreclosures were addressed by the CARES Act, which may have reduced popular pressure on our state government to act. I think in addition to the $600 of extra unemployment benefits running out, the next cliff in this thing is going to be the evictions picking up, right? I think that's absolutely going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, in my not working time, I work with a charity group that deals a lot with homelessness, and they are very, very worried about this coming up.
Yeah.
And I have a couple of friends who've been out of work and not paying rent and then working on, you know, their arrangements with their landlords, and they're freaking out. It's different in every state and community, though. The National Low Income Housing Coalition has this big, long list that they've been maintaining of, like, what the different rules are in each places. But, I agree with you. We're coming to that cliff, and it's going to be rough.
And can you imagine having to work, you know, maybe some job that exposes you to the risk of getting this virus, and you've got a couple of kids who aren't in school, and you have to plow through all the rules and regulations to try to figure this out. At the same time, you're worried about making enough money to pay the rent to begin with. It's Byzantine. And anyway, yeah, it's going
to
be an issue.
Yeah, but you have to, you know, imagine slash hope that, you know, it's sort of like the commercial real estate situation. Yes, they could, you know, kick out all these small businesses for not paying rent, but who's going to fill those spaces? And so one could make the argument that how effective is it for you as a landlord to push out all of these people who can't pay their rent when, you know, what, a third of the population is out of work right now? Something like that. So, you know, who are you going to get to fill that spot?
My rejoinder would be like smaller landlords would be able to do that, right? They'd carry the debt or whatever. My guess would be the big corporate landlords are going to be like, no, boom, the machine will kick into gear and those notices will start going out and there won't be consideration given to actual humanity, which sounds terrible. God, can we move? Let's move on. That's terrible.
Very quickly, though.
Yeah, of course.
When people there is an economic consequence that's a follow-on of that, because losing your housing is sort of the beginning of this, you know, cascading effect that has other economic consequences. So just like apparently an economic argument gets people to wear a mask more so than saving people's lives, one could argue that maybe you shouldn't throw people out of their homes because it will have ripple effects to damage the rest of the economy.
There was a story the other day on my local public radio station here in Los Angeles, KPCC, that pointed out that a lot of people think homelessness is the end of an economic decline. It's actually the beginning. Because from there, as you just said, things go south in a big, bad hurry. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Next question comes from listener Aaron Hubbard. It's a new spin on an old question, and Aaron sent this in via voice memo.
Hi, Make Me Smart team. This is Aaron in New Hampshire. I've been hearing Kai lament how it doesn't make any sense that the stock market keeps going up, and I have been remarkably confused by it as well. But then I heard that it's probably happening because the feds are buying up stocks and bonds from large corporations, including Apple and others. Does that explain it? Is that actually happening?
All right, Kyle the Lamenter, what do you think?
Well, so they're buying bonds of companies. They're not buying stocks, right? That would be a whole new hullabaloo, open up the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 thing before the Fed bought actually stocks in companies. But they are in various ways buying stocks from big companies. Do I believe that that's the thing that's driving the market itself? No, many other Fed actions are. I don't think that's the one that is. I think the early injections of liquidity certainly are. And that's my sense. Also, the stock market is an idiot, or as Sabri Benishore said on Marketplace 6 weeks or 8 weeks ago, it's an alien, right? I mean, it was up today because there was a positive report on a vaccine test of like 8 people. I mean, they're looking for the upside. They're just looking for the upside. That is my take.
But to Aaron's point, like, there are many people out there arguing that the Fed and other global central banks intervening in the markets the way that they are is really shifting what's going on, to the point that, like, an investment banker Ray Dalio was saying a couple weeks ago, that it's no longer a free market. It's being propped up by all of these central banks and all of their injections of liquidity.
Yeah.
But right. So I was curious about this too, Aaron. I was talking with the president of the Dallas Fed, Robert Kaplan, earlier this week, and I asked him specifically about this. And mm-hmm. he was saying, no, it's still a free market, and we're watching to see if there's any distortions that we're creating in the market as a result of our intervention and all those things. But his point about whether or not, like, this was making the market unrealistic, he said, look, the market is always looking a couple of years in advance, like a year or two out. And so that's why you're seeing, this is me extrapolating from what he's saying, that's why you're seeing these big swings every time there's an announcement of a vaccine, because it changes what that 1 to 2 year outlook looks like, you know, depending on what happens with the virus. And that eventually what the market does and what the rest of the economy does will converge. That's his argument. I mean, I'm still in my non-economist, non-market trader person perspective on the people who are trading in the markets are not the people who are out of work. And so there's a little bit of disconnect there. But that's my take.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, who knows with the market, right? Who knows? I mean, you can make a case that the Nasdaq's doing so well. Right. You can make a case that the Nasdaq's doing so well because all the tech companies like Facebook and, you know, all those other companies are getting more business because people are at home, and, you know, oil and gas companies aren't. I mean, there's 1,000 ways you can slice this thing. Anyway.
Yeah. Sorry, Aaron.
I don't know. Kathy Tarquin. We're going to go with Tarquin. Is one of several people who asked this question. Came up oh so briefly on a previous episode, but it does merit a little more discussion because I just think it's so cool that this is happening in a weird economy way. Here's what Kathy wants to know. What's up with the national coin change shortage? Is this actually a true issue that we have right now in America? I was at the Dollar Tree in my neighborhood, and I saw a sign that asked for paying customers to use exact change if using cash. And then I went to another Dollar Tree on the total opposite side of town, and they said they had the same request with the same reason of a national coin shortage. This is so strange, she says, and I was hoping you could shed some light on it. Yes, it's true. And in point of fact, the woman whose name you will hear at the end of the credits today was talking to me the other day about Ralph's, our local grocery store. And she said the cashier had mentioned to her the coin shortage. It's a real thing because we're not getting out there and spending real coins. It's kind of wild.
Yeah, let's blame all of our relatives with the giant water jugs full of coins sitting in the back.
That's me. I must have $300 upstairs on my dresser. It's the God's honest truth.
I believe it.
I do.
Sometimes
and then probably
I'll go
another 50 bucks in the office. Yeah.
Sometimes I'll go to the pharmacy. Well, in the before times, I would go to the pharmacy and late at night, the 24-hour pharmacy, with my little bag of leftover coins so that I could pay at the self-checkout with my coins but not bother anybody because there was nobody else there. But this gets to sort of how money moves through the economy and how these disruptions and how the very fundamental ways that we live our lives. I mean, and if you think about the laundromat example, I mean, not to be too much information, I'm not doing as much laundry as I used to.
Ooh, hold on. Hold on.
We'll leave that out there. But I imagine a lot of people, they're not going to the laundromat as much. They're not going to places where there are vending machines as much. And so all of these things kind of play into just like even just how money is moving to be Cardi B in this moment.
Like literally moving. The person who owns the laundromat goes in twice a week or whatever it is, empties out the quarter jars, right? Takes them to her local bank, right? They take it. They deposit it in larger banks up the chain till it gets the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve distributes that coinage out through the economy. And the problem is there's no intake now because we're not doing that stuff. And so the Fed has set up a U.S. coin task force, and they're trying to figure out ways to get people to actually spend all this coinage. It's a big deal. It's a big deal.
Coinage.
Kind of wild. I kind of love it. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Should we get in one more?
Let's get one more. Yeah. It's a good one.
Yeah. Okay. So Dustin Relathford? Sorry, Dustin. Dustin Relathford says, my question is about inclusivity and diversity in the workplace. Specifically, how do you accomplish it in industries where there is not a big pipeline of diverse workers? So since this seems to be like my topic day month, it...
You go.
I think the pipeline problem has to be addressed in a very purposeful way. So, for example, we do not have a lot of black men, for example, in public media. We just do not. And so if you do not have a lot of black men working in internships and in member stations and feeding into that sort of track that a lot of people go into to create that pipeline, you have one of two choices to fix that problem. You either try to make sure a ton of black men get internships to begin the pipeline and hope they make it through the other end, or you fast track it and say, wow, we recognize there are no black men in public radio at the national level, so we are going to create this spot for that person and train them to that role with the fact, you know, acknowledging that this is a problem. And so those are the two ideas that I see kind of floating around. What do you think?
No, I think that's exactly right. I guess just to keep up the public radio thing and the serious lack of black men specifically in public radio, what do you do look, and this is not your question to answer, right? But what do you do when those black men get fed up and leave?
What do you mean? What have we done when those black men get fed up?
Well, yeah. I mean, you and I both know men who have said, the heck with this. This is terrible. I can't stick around for this. And that's,
yeah, I think, I mean, well, I think in that case, you either fix this, you try to fix the structures that creates an untenable environment where these black men cannot feel safe or succeed. And I'm not going to say or, I'll say and you hope that you've done enough work on that front end of the pipeline to where if those black men have better opportunities that, you know, encourage them to go, there's someone to step in behind them. And I mean, this is pretty, you know, simplistic of a very complicated discussion and narrative, but that you can extrapolate this out to any other industry, whether it be the underrepresentation of women in a particular sector. Well, you can either put them in, but in that, that just reminded me of something else, because if you do that, then you end up with all of these women and people of color with no power at the front end trying to fix an industry that's problematic. So it has to be really purposeful. It has to be about changing a culture to make it more welcoming and inclusive. I mean, I can say that as a woman of color in journalism, early in my career, I'm talking when I was 16 and when I was 19 years old, I had these, you know, middle-aged white men who just decided that they were going to make sure that I succeeded, and they were running interference all over the place for me. And making sure that I got opportunities, making sure that I got jobs, making sure people didn't mess with me, because they just decided that that was what they were going to do. And that made all the difference. Not all the difference. Lots of people helped, but it made a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. That's good. That's good. Okay, we're going to leave it there on that hopeful note, because there's work to be done. by all of us.
Oh, and God bless, we can end on a hopeful note for once.
I know. That's right. Right. Well, that's why I'm running for the exits here, because we got to go out on an up note. Got to go out on an up note.
Yes.
All right, we're done. Back tomorrow. Holiday Out Shell Thursday is what we call it. Question, if you have it, send it to us, makemesmart at marketplace.org. Sign up for our newsletters, please, marketplace.org/newsletters, and hit the music.
Yes, the music. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Digital producer is Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcoat is the video producer, and Ethan Peretz is our video intern. And Erica Phillips write with such flair our newsletter and smart speaker skills.
Charlton Thorpe is on duty in downtown Los Angeles today at 261 South Figueroa. Theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand this week is Satara Nieves, also senior producing this podcast, I do believe. Senior vice president and general manager, and also the woman who told me the coin anecdote, is Deborah Clark. There you go.
All right.
So I should probably take all those coins and run them through the coin master thing.
And I swear I am doing some laundry. It's just not a lot. Definitely in longer intervals. Because, you know, the social distancing in the laundry room is hard.